Hi, this is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. Two Central American countries will hold presidential votes in November, and concerns abound about the integrity of the electoral process in both cases. But there are plenty of differences between them as well. In the case of Nicaragua's November 7th contest, Daniel Ortega has stacked the decks in his favor, arresting critics and chasing the opposition into exile, ahead of an election widely viewed as a sham to ensure his fifth term in power.
El combate a las guerras, a las invasiones, a las intervenciones.
Meanwhile, in Honduras, voters will pick a new president on November 28th. They worry about a repeat of the last election, when delayed results sparked claims of fraud and bloody clashes. I spoke with Juan Pablo Savillon, who founded the organization El Milenio in the wake of that turbulent election.
There were severe fraud allegations after the 2017 election. Basically the inspiration was really just the absence of a platform or a forum where young people could engage in civilized dialogue.
4 years later, the group is using digital tools to inform and motivate young voters in the 2021 election. But first, my colleague Chase Harrison spoke with the International Crisis Group's Tiziano Breda. With an eye on Nicaragua, he explores the opposition's position and how the international community could respond in an election many are calling fake. Breda then shares the view from Honduras, where voters, worn out by scandals and political divisions, worry another tight election could spark more unrest.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
Podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Tiziano, thank you so much for coming on the Latin America in Focus podcast.
Now, thanks to you for having me, Chase.
Central America has two elections coming up in November in Nicaragua and Honduras. And I thought we'd start off with the one that is sooner, which is in Nicaragua on November 7th. Though it seems the result of that election is pretty much predetermined. Daniel Ortega will likely assume a fifth term in office, his fourth consecutive term, because he's jailed much of the opposition, including seven presidential hopefuls. What will you be watching for on the day of the election? What's still up in the air in an election that seems to be so set, predetermined in its outcome?
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple of areas which will be interesting to look at. And the first of it is the turnout, the overall turnout, because it will be a test both for Ortega to demonstrate is still white, or at least to a certain extent, ability to bring people to vote, because they support to the ruling party and to the president in recent years has remained overall stable at around between 20% and 30% of all surveys. But of course it will be, it has waned recently in the wake of this latest wave of repression, which has, as you said, beheaded basically all the opposition main movements, and including the parties that they could have run for, and the leaders, the most renowned leaders of opposition movements. But also it will be a test for the opposition to demonstrate its still sway on the Nicaraguan society, because of course the many opposition movements have called for people to remain at home, to not go to the polling stations, to basically show that the unpopularity of Ortega is greater than the core support base that it still has. But there was a lot of disillusionment that actually the evolution of the opposition movements prompted in much of the sectors of the society who did not favor or were opposed to Ortega, but do not see a credible alternative actually to it. So we'll have to see the turnout. And secondly, and that's most concerning possibly, it's the possibility that the media coverage, for example, will face a lot of pressure by security forces and Ortega supporters, and that we could see some localized episodes of intolerance and violence around the election, although with the unlikelihood that this turned into mass protests along the likes of the 2018 events.
Yeah. Even if there's low turnout, it's tricky to topple an authoritarian regime through abstention. So where does the opposition go from here? What do they do if there are localized protests or if there is a large-scale rejection of the election or its results? Is there a path forward?
That's going to be the greatest challenge for the opposition because they are now in complete disarray. As we said, that most of their most renowned leaders are either in jail or under house arrest or have had to hide in the country and remain silent or to flee the country and become exiled. So many of the opposition groups that arose in 2018 or that spearheaded the 2018 protests are trying to regroup abroad, particularly in Costa Rica and the US. But the internal presence has become quite weaker. So the greatest challenge is for the opposition movements to regroup, to re-nurture the 2018 sentiment that, as I was mentioning, was a bit lost in transition, because these movements focused a lot on struggling over power quotas and electoral interests in the past couple of years, and these infightings basically prevailed over the need to nurture the basis that can support them at the local level. So that, I think, will be the greatest challenge ahead.
Obviously, a solution to this crisis has to happen domestically. It has to come from Managua. But this election has attracted a lot of international interest. What more can the international community be doing on November 7th or moving forward to try to help the opposition and the pro-democracy movement more generally in the country?
Well, we are of the opinion that the international community needs to fine-tune a more coordinated and clear and robust response to what's going to happen on November 7th than it has done before. Because, of course, the response has been scattered, mainly based on individual sanctions. The US has imposed several rounds of these sanctions. The EU also has imposed a couple of rounds of sanctions. But in a very shattered and uncoordinated way, and above all, with unclear demands to the government for also the sanctions to be lifted at some point. This has proven to be quite ineffective in the medium term to press Ortega or persuade Ortega into making concessions. So we believe that there's a need for the OAS and regional partners, the EU, the US, to come up with a clear, coordinated response to the and stance to the November 7th rigged poll, and with a clear set of demands that are laid out in a roadmap of some sort to be presented to Ortega for him to also restore some working relations with governments with the aim of finding a negotiated solution out of the political crisis that the country has been experiencing since 2018, rather than helping just one side of basically the opposition groups to regroup and to wave their battle.
I'd like to pivot from an election that's essentially one candidate to an election that's a bit more competitive, the election in Honduras on November 28th, where there are three main candidates. The field got winnowed down a little bit a couple weeks ago from four main candidates when Salvador Nasralla, who got second place in the 22nd teen contest, endorsed Xiomara Castro of the Libre Party. And this consolidated the opposition to the current government a bit in this election. So how unified is the opposition now behind Xiomara? And how big of a deal was this endorsement in terms of her chances of winning the election?
Well, surely Xiomara Castro has developed a more conciliatory and balanced image and presidential image, basically, over the past few months. And the alliance with Nasralla, which repeat the one that was already staged in 2017, just flipping who's the leading presidential candidate, definitely instilled some more hope that a less fragmented opposition could have more chances to actually challenge the ruling National Party. But still, she's not a unifying character. She's perceived as very much the mirror of former President Mel Zelaya, who's the leader of Libre, the party she runs for, and who is not so much well-received by many other sectors. He's taken on a very quite leftist narratives and discourse that creates antibodies among other sectors, including some sectors that voted or would have voted for Nasralla, which are basically either youngsters who reject the overall political party system and traditional political figures, which include Xiomara Castro and Mel Zelaya, or nationalists or liberals that were disillusioned and deceived by their respective parties, but would not necessarily support Libre in such an election. So it definitely increases the odds for the opposition to win the presidency, at least, but it's not necessarily a mathematical addition of the two vote support bases.
One of the factors that's causing the widespread distrust in politics that you mentioned, especially among groups like young Hondurans, is the prevalence of corruption in Honduran politics. Of the three major candidates, all of them have corruption allegations, indictments, or they're connected to corrupt figures. How are voters processing an election where every candidate has allegations of corruption against them?
I think we're moved past beyond the times where corruption allegations and scandals moved or shifted the voting tensions from one candidate to the other. As you said, the system or the main political parties are all perceived as basically being tainted by corrupt practices to, you know, different extents possibly, but there's a widespread perception that there's little difference basically between the three parties because of the many corruption scandals, which of course involved mostly the ruling National Party, as it was the party in power for the last 12 years, but also the other ones. So what I think the greatest or most evident consequences of this perception of corruption is translating into a greater distrust at the political system, at the electoral authorities, in democracy itself, and can translate into greater abstention or even basically a desire to leave the country eventually when more and more people do not feel that there's any opening, any possibility to bring about change.
When we talk about democracy in Honduras and citizen levels of trust in democracy, a big factor in the country is the prevalence of clientelistic practices, where politicians or parties are giving goods, services, patronage, jobs to Hondurans. How much is clientelism continuing to operate in the country? And I'm wondering specifically about the effect of both the pandemic and the two hurricanes that have caused a lot of chaos and disorder on the ground in Honduras. Has this affected the way clientelism operates?
Well, the ruling National Party has become very professional in developing a patronage practices throughout the country and to oil its institutional machinery, basically, to ensure a core solid amount of votes throughout the country. And these include, as you said, expanding the public sector's employment to several dozens, more than 100, I think, public employees, jobs paid by the state, on one hand. And on the other hand, to use the humanitarian aid and the resources that came about and that were unleashed basically by international financial institutions, by other partners to cope with the impact of the pandemic and the hurricanes of last year, to use these resources to basically look more benevolent and basically use hunger in a political way. So all the humanitarian food bags that are being distributed still are being used in the electoral context to promote the image of the government and bring about votes. But also bonuses that were meant to be to reignite the economy after the pandemic are being given to people with the condition that they find enough votes to bring to the National Party. So that this practice has been really has taken roots in the country's politics and has become very predominant.
And the National Party that you talk about has been in power for a while now, since the 2009 coup that saw President Manuel Zelaya removed from office after he made some efforts to remove the ban on re-election in Honduras. Not only was the 2009 coup a dramatic and impactful event in Honduran politics, but the previous election, the 2017 election, saw widespread allegations of fraud during the first ever re-election in Honduras of a president, which was Juan Orlando Hernandez. Did the 2009 coup and the 2017 election continue to haunt Honduras or define the way that politics are operating in the country? Or is this election its own scenario?
No, I absolutely think that these two are benchmarks in the country's politics, and they influence the country's politics in two levels, at least. The higher political levels at the party's cupolas level, which is still very much affected by the 2009 coup d'etat. There are very personal ideological divisions and intentions that are nurtured and with the still vivid images of the or memories of the 2009 coup d'etat. But at the social level, what's probably even more impactful is definitely the 2017 events, because the, as you said, the widespread perception was that eventually there was fraud, even though the international electoral observation missions was not so much clear about that. It talked more about irregularities rather than outright fraud. But the perception was that there was actually fraud. And the feeling is that this time around, the National Party will try and meddle with the election again to remain in power and to repeat that kind of scenario, with the difference that all the griefs that were created by this wave of repression, actually, to the protests in 2017, bringing to the death of more than 20 people, at least, can fuel further hatred and further a more angry reaction if that is perceived to be happening again this time around.
The Honduran election, as you mentioned, has always been a tricky election for international actors and observers to monitor and to figure out how to support democracy in the country. But one international conflict that's bleeding into this year's election is that between Taiwan and China. Honduras is one of just 15 countries worldwide that recognizes Taiwan instead of China. And Taiwan has recently accused China of creating controversy during the Honduran election and for making flashy and false promises. What's happening with this international conflict in the Honduran election?
I think this is becoming a pivotal issue and a topic that leaders, not only in Honduras, but in other Central American countries, are trying to use to increase the leverage in their relationship with the U.S. So far, the National Party government, presided over by President Juan Orlando Hernández, has remained loyal, if you want to put it that way, has remained in the position of acknowledging or recognizing Taiwan and keeping China sort of away, between brackets, from the country. The issue of China was actually used by the ruling National Party in the current campaign to attack Libre, who instead proposed in his government plan to establish relations with China. But at the same time, President Hernández has hinted at some issues of strategic interest, for example, to China in terms of infrastructure, in public appearances, particularly a recent one with President Ortega, which to me sent us a message to Washington as well, to try and keep distance and increase the leverage of the incumbent as he starts to approach his the end of his term.
Two small countries with two big and potentially impactful elections for the hemisphere and the whole globe. But maybe there'll be a glimmer of hope in both cases that democracy can prevail and the people can have their voice heard. Tiziano, thank you so much for coming on the Latin America in Focus podcast.
Donald, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure, Chase.
That was Tiziano Breda, Central American analyst at International Crisis Group, talking with Chase Harrison. Next, Honduras has one of the lowest levels of support for democracy out of any country in Latin America. I talked with Juan Pablo Sabillon, founder of El Milenio, about how his country's younger voters view the political process and what his organization is doing to get them to vote. Thank you so much for being with us today, Juan Pablo.
Oh, thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here talking about El Milenio and Honduran elections and democracy. It's a pleasure.
So to start off, what is El Milenio? Why did you found it?
So El Milenio is essentially a youth advocacy organization in Honduras. It is the first nonpartisan platform for youth freedom of speech in Honduras. Our purpose is really to give a voice to young Hondurans who want to speak about issues that matter to them. We do this primarily through two ways, right? So the first one is to provide young Hondurans with a medium to elevate their voices on key political issues through op-eds, podcasts, speaking forums, and debates. And the second is really to encourage and motivate young Hondurans to participate in the strengthening of democratic institutions, civism, and to really get involved in positions of leadership in the social political arena, regardless of their political views.
So when did you start it? What was the initial spark for getting it going?
Yeah, so I founded El Milenio after the 2017 post-electoral crisis. And to sort of tell you the story, right, I was basically in my college dorm, literally watching my city burning in flames, right? There were severe fraud allegations after the 2017 election. And, you know, basically the inspiration was really just the absence of a platform or a forum where young people could engage in civilized dialogue, right? The other thing I really analyzed in that moment is that was the first election where social media was really a vital component and enabler of political discourse, right? So saw that there were a lot of young people speaking out, some of them making proposals, criticizing, sort of letting all the stress and discouragement, in some cases, they were letting it out, going to the streets. But there wasn't really a centralized, but at the same time, open platform where people could share their ideas. And you know, I think that was a very key moment for El Milenio's birth, where anyone, regardless of your political ideology, would have an open platform to speak out and to talk about the issues in a civilized way, because that is the contrary of what we saw from our leaders, especially in that crisis of 2017.
What are you really trying to focus on and look at right now in these upcoming elections in November?
Yeah, so I'll say that a key piece that El Milenio is trying to fight against is indifference in general. We know of a lot of institutional challenges that our democracies are facing in Central America and what is known as today as the Northern Triangle. And there is sort of like this diagnostic, right, of what needs to be done to solve the issue. It's just a matter of doing it. But what I think we don't speak enough about is the cultural norms that are also decaying, that really have a huge influence on our democracy and the participation, right? So, you know, for example, the indifference or support towards democracy has dramatically decreased in the past 10 years in Honduras by 23 percentage points. It is the lowest score in Latin America. You know, one phrase we really like to say in Honduras is, votar es un deber cívico. Voting is a civic duty. But what we're seeing is that doesn't resonate with young voters anymore. You know, we need a nuanced approach to getting people motivated and go out and participate.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I was looking at the recent Latino Barometer survey that just came out, which you might have been referencing with some of your statistics. And I found that in Honduras, only 34% of people support democracy as the best form of government, and that the percent who are indifferent to democracy versus having an authoritarian form of government runs around 41%. And according to the study, it runs even higher among young voters. So how do you turn that around? And how are young voters feeling in this election right now?
Those are, you know, some very worrying statistics. You know, the other one I would flag, which was really scary for our organization to look at, was prior to the primaries in March, where, you know, 60% of millennials said that they wouldn't go out to vote in that election. And beyond that, they wanted to leave the country, right? Where, you know, young people are the great majority of voters in this upcoming election. I believe it's more than 3 million young voters who will be attending the poll, aged, you know, 18 to 35 year olds. But, you know, I think the key thing that El Milenio is focusing on and that I really like to touch upon is our electoral information AI tool, which we developed in March. It's called Emil, you know, noting coming from El Milenio. And it's basically a WhatsApp bot, right, used to provide basic information to voters on their candidates to Congress. I think that this tool was really an organic sort of like traditional design thinking process, how it came to fruition. And it basically came up as, you know, El Milenio, a group of young Hondurans wanting to take a creative approach to solving an electoral issue. And that was, you have hundreds of candidates on the ballot for Congress, which, by the way, is the most important branch of government in Honduras because we're a republic, right? The decisions that most greatly impact Hondurans every day are taken in Congress. And people don't know anything about their candidates. You know, there's like the hot button issue of corruption, but we talk with hundreds of young people. And yes, corruption is a concern, but they just don't know the basic information or profile about a candidate. They don't know anything, and they see 200 faces on the ballot, right?
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, people ended up voting for like footballers or celebrities, TV personalities, when we need economists, political scientists, and constitutional lawyers. So there were two issues, right? The first is that there was like no easily accessible information on candidates. Voters didn't know anything about all the faces in the ballot. The second is that there was no synthesized or centralized platform to access the information. So what did we do? We essentially did a titanic, you know, youth-energized effort to gather information from candidates. And it needs to come from the candidate, right? Because it's very hard to find this information openly in Honduras. Other initiatives asked for like complex questions. We really went for the basics because that's what we knew the voters wanted. It was fast for the candidate to give us that. What do you do for a living? You know, have you served in Congress before and for how many years? If you get to Congress, what is your number one priority? Like your number one issue? Where do you stand ideologically? So once we have like all that data. And we did the pilot in March, and we were able to capture from two departments, which were our priority for the pilot, about 212 candidates. And then how do we distribute it to the most amount of people possible?
Yeah.
And the way we did it was through WhatsApp, which is the most used social media in Honduras. And we basically created a bot, which you could contact, you know, through a WhatsApp contact message. And he would ask you, hey, like, what department are you voting in? And you would answer. And then it would ask you, what party do you want to see? It was sort of like a conversation. And then you got the information, right? And you could see the profiles and their policy stances and where they wanted to go.
And I'm curious, do you have any idea how many people you're reaching through this bot?
For the pilot, we had over 7,000 users that sent a total of 113,000 messages. But what we learned early in the process when the bot launched is that people were not necessarily just going into the bot or contacting it, but those users were forwarding the information to other people. So it's exponentially distributed. And that's what really we were getting at. And for the general election, we really want to target 50,000 users. Mm-hmm. That's our goal. And directly, right? Indirectly, that could, you know, transfer easily to a quarter of a million.
So back to the audience that you're serving, you mentioned, I think you said it was about 3 million voters are in that age range up to 35 and under, which is amazing when we think about the fact that there are 5.3 million registered, I think it's 5.2 million yeah. registered voters, right? Correct. So a huge portion is of the voting population is relatively young. Can I ask you, what is really concerning younger voters? What are the top issues for younger voters when they're showing up to cast their ballots now in 2021?
Yeah, I think the number one priority is lack of opportunity for young people. And that comes in different forms. Again, that is the number one reason why people are migrating and leaving in caravans. Many people are educated, but they are underemployed or can't find a good quality job. And then another good portion of the young population just has not had access to education, basic or university education. And that is a real issue, especially in the context, in the more global context, right? Because with the pandemic, economies are exponentially digitalizing and advancing and progressing. You know, we have artificial intelligence, which could be in 5 or 10 years a devastating threat to the economy in Honduras. So I think that is the number one reason why young people will go out and vote. If they reach the ballot, they will go out and vote, right? And I think that is an underlying point that we really have to tackle in our country, because the combination of lack of trust in political institutions and the electoral council, the rhetoric that is led by long-term politicians, which is increasingly gearing or aiming towards, you know, political violence, and just a sense of hopelessness, which in research is showing as one of the most important factors for why people migrate, because they have just lost hope in the country. That are issues that deter a voter from reaching the polls, especially young people. And that is where the titanic effort from organizations like El Milenio and a lot of other young advocacy organizations and the private sector have to come into play and have to say, you know, our democracy is backsliding. I feel I'm young, but I'm very old school. You know, something that I feel is that we don't remember how hard it was for Honduras to become a democracy. We went through various coups and military dictatorships and failed attempts to a republic. And then we finally got it in 82. And, you know, we are at a point where we could lose that, right? And I think that in November, it will be the most important election up to our history, because if we don't achieve a Congress that can help improve checks and balances, pick a new judiciary and enforce rule of law or even rebuild the rule of law, Honduras is going to go through very tough times in the couple of 8 years.
One last question I have for you. Let's say this election is over. We're a couple of years down the road, hopefully out of this pandemic. What do you see as the future for El Milenio? What would you hope El Milenio can accomplish in future elections?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, every time I talk with my team, who is a fantastic group of young Hondurans who, some of them have studied abroad and others, you know, are at home and are across rural and urban areas. I always tell them, you know, some people would not go out to vote if it weren't for an organization like ours. And not only ours, but many others who do a great job of galvanizing young people. So what I really would like in the future is, number one, that young people take over the organization, because again, I won't be young forever. So it would a generational handover of more young Hondurans who are committed to democratic ideals, that are committed to minimum basic agreements, which is respecting institutions and respecting the right of others to have a different political opinion. If El Milenio in 4 or 8 years continues to be that, I think it will be a great success. And most importantly, I think that there's a new wave of young Hondurans who share these values. You know, we grew up after the 2009 coup d'etat. We've grown up in instability. And I think that we are very hungry and very optimistic, and we will fight for democratic ideals and for everyone in Honduras to have a regular life, you know, that can aspire to protect their families and have job security and live in prosperity. I think that is where I see El Milenio playing a part. And, you know, I can tell you something, that young Hondurans are committed to this, and we will go. I am not going anywhere. I want to grow up in Honduras. I want to live there with my family. And I'm willing to fight alongside a lot of other Hondurans who are willing to do the same.
Great. Thank you so much for being with me today. It's really been great to hear about your organization and the work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Luisa Leme. Learn more about this year in Latin American elections at as-coa.org/2021. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. For more about concerts online, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, help us spread the word. Write a review, give us 5 stars, share, and subscribe at Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.